Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler, and we've got a few clips to cover in the current news. We're going to bring you up to date on a few things. It looks like Corsi is back on the air and reporting and analyzing some new reports from QAnon. We'll delve into that later. But first, I want to let Corsi say his piece on this Federal Trade Commission regulation are maintaining internet freedoms or internet bill of rights, I believe. But anyway, he's going to be speaking here on this clip about the internet bill of rights, and he has some very, very important things to say. So this is something not to overlook, but listen carefully to this and see what you think. We're in a situation now where these Facebook and Google and them got so large that the only way to possibly regulate them is through some kind of a Federal Trade Commission type of approach. But listen carefully what Corsi has to say.
What President Trump let everybody know, including, I believe, YouTube, was that the government does not have an interest in regulating in owning and operating the Internet. President Trump does not want a government take over the Internet, and I was very pleased to get that message back. But he was also saying, the White House was saying, and letting YouTube know that there's going to have to be what we've been calling this Internet Bill of Rights. And I want to start people again with the hashtagging Internet Bill of Rights. And I'd like to see some more memes come up and people presenting memes on the Internet and on the various channels, that we can get this idea across to the world that the Internet's got to be an open, free and open market. It's got to be open for free expression of ideas. Lori G., the Internet Bill of Rights was actually started, I mean, it was an idea that AT&T had, and AT&T was the one who came up with this, and the plastic surgeon, thank you very much. Everybody, the outpouring of love and support here is just really gratifying. 128 engineer, thank you all so much. I mean, I'm doing what I can, and, you know, it's heartfelt always when I'm doing the analysis. And my goal here is to make sure we preserve the republic, we preserve for the next generations the freedoms that we've enjoyed. When AT&T came up with this, and of course people said, well, AT&T is a big international corporation and they're part of the New World Order, so we need to be aware or worried about or concerned about any idea that AT&T might be advancing. Kathleen Graham, thank you very much. Everyone here, I want you to know that, you know, people have sent me small amounts. That means huge amount to me. It's not so much that, I mean, your outpouring of love for any amounts that it's Northern Iraq. Someone can just contribute it from Northern Iraq. I mean, how wonderful can that be? I want to extend to Northern Iraq my feelings of love, my hopes and prayers that freedom comes and peace finally to your country in Iraq and to the entire Middle East. So I'm saying that AT&T advanced this idea, and AT&T is been very close to President Trump trying to get this Time Warner deal done. It was blocked by some of the holdovers from the Obama administration and the Justice Department. That at issue is whether AT&T would get CNN and would bring CNN into a more conservative direction. And I think basically the president wants to see AT&T not have to divert or divest itself from CNN in order to make the deal work with Time Warner. That's now in the litigation in the federal district court. So basically, I got a hold of this idea, the Internet Bill of Rights, evaluated it from AT&T, and said that this is right on target. This is what we need. We need to make sure that the Internet has the same freedoms that we enjoy in free speech. Jed Steele, thank you. And as that idea advanced, and I think what President Trump was explaining to YouTube was that this is either going to be litigated in the federal district courts, or it's going to be in the FCC and the FTC. Quite frankly, I think the Trump administration is moving towards the FTC to do the regulation of the Internet. It has more robust powers. It can deal with protection of privacy, I think, in a superior way. YSR979, thank you. Andy Wallace. This is Jet Drive Driver 2, thank you. The Trump administration saying we're going to have an Internet Bill of Rights. Government's not going to take over the Internet. And YouTube is going to have to find a way to let diverse political views be expressed, especially when our interest here is freedom. The FCC is, I want to make sure everybody follows this precisely. The FCC is the Federal Communications Commission. And under President Obama, the FCC was going to regulate the Internet. We were going to regulate it. Some of this is a little complicated, but under Title II of the Communications Act. And then the FTC is the Federal Trade Commission. These are two different groups, regulators, and I think the FTC is going to be a better regulator because it has... someone was saying, look, small contribution, no one needs to apologize for any small contribution. They're appreciated as much. It's not the dollar sign. I'm looking at the expression of love. I'm looking at someone who may give a dollar. That dollar may mean a lot to that person. It means a lot to me. And please don't think you have to contribute a lot in order to make an impact on me. I'm grateful for everyone who does contribute anything. Gets my true feeling of thanks and appreciation. I can't tell you. Mega, thank you very much. Mega, thank you very much. It's pounds from London. Okay, so first of all, AT&T does not have anything to do with the FTC or the FCC. AT&T was just saying we need to apply the principles of the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights, to the Internet so that we have a forum that's open to all peoples of all political views and hopefully around the world. That's what I love so much about everybody participating around the world. This is a human question. This is a question all of us as human beings share. This is one that we all continue to be invested in order to preserve the discourse that we need to be free as human beings. John Stuart Mill said it the best, we have to tolerate this political speech that we'd like to hear the least. Now, when you're trying to regulate out violence, when you're trying to regulate out terrorism, that's another thing, and no one should be feeling that they have the right to threaten or to advocate violence or advocate terrorism to anyone else. I abhor violence. I've had to study it much of my life, and I've always worked to try to prevent violence to make sure that we can argue these issues out in free discourse. But free discourse has got to be open to all views. It's got to be open to views you don't like to hear, that you think are wrong. And the remedy there is not intolerance. It worries me that the left is going for intolerance. I don't think so much it was that the YouTube was afraid of AT&T, is that YouTube was concerned that if it was going to try to disbar, remove conservatives from using the channel under the argument that its private company can do what it want. Jackie Bart, thank you very much. The argument of restricting free speech was going to mean that President Trump was going to get involved and was going to be able to get to say we need to have not throwing people off the site because they're conservatives or libertarians or whatever, or advocate one position or another position, but that YouTube is not going to have the power, nor is anyone else going to have the power on the internet to run a channel on broadband, you know, sharing a public resource, a public utility, and it's got to be open to all. It's got to be open to people of all persuasions, all races, all points of view. You know, it can't be a forum that's only limited to what a small group on the hard left considers politically correct. We're not interested in a cultural revolution, a thought reform. We want this to be an open and robust discussion. And the concern was that, really from the White House, really concern from regulators who want the utility, want the internet to be open to all, that before the midterm elections, that YouTube could have been exerting a political agenda, saying one of the reasons President Trump won was all the support he got out of the conservative movement on the internet, and if we can block that as leftists, and let's be honest about it. I mean, Eric Schmidt, who was the creator, one of the major forces, CEOs of Google and then Alphabet, was very involved in the leftist causes, one of Hillary Clinton's primary supporters. And so politically it looks to the White House and it looked to the regulators that the idea was YouTube was going to get rid of all conservatives before the midterm elections in order to have an electoral advantage, in order to be able to have the leftist agenda be all that was heard on the internet. And when you get a force that's as big as Google or at much share of the market of the internet as YouTube, the White House regulators who were looking at the First Amendment were saying we've got to keep this open for the entire world, and we've got to keep it open for all points of view. So when YouTube changed its mind, I think YouTube decided that they didn't want to take on this issue at this time. The issues of whether or not Google's a monopoly needs to be broken up, whether these big forces on the internet, Facebook and the others, even Amazon. You know, in the 1890s, what happened was that these various companies formed trusts. They formed a basic issue that they could control entire industries and all the industries related to it, all steel, railroads, controlled under one entity. And the public policy was to break those up because you don't want to have a market controlled or dominated by, you know, a few people or a concentration of economic power that blasts out all others. You know, people are saying, people are raising, who's going to get the contract to bring 5G to us? That's another issue we're going to have to take a very hard look at. A little bit off topic here, but a very important issue. I wanted to acknowledge it. Let's stay on this issue of free speech. The point is that we're going to have an Internet Bill of Rights, and the concept came from AT&T, and I want to acknowledge that, but I don't want people to think that it's a concept that's designed to have power for AT&T. It's for all of us to share this kind of power. People are saying there's 3,600 people watching this today. That's tremendous. And from all over the world, thank you very much. We don't want to have YouTube blocking conservatives, throwing me off the channel. And if I was me and Alex Jones and InfoWars, we'd just be the first. I mean, it's like almost election fraud that one company with such a large dominance in the market, YouTube, could try to throw others off and try to get everything going to one candidate or one political view, a leftist, hard left political view. I want my friends on the left to understand that I acknowledge that the left has a full right to have its points argued, but the intolerance, the wanting to destroy conservatives, please give us the same courtesy of being able to express our views. And please, if your arguments on the left are stronger, defeat our arguments on the right. I'm happy to be wrong if it's shown in debate, if it's shown in discussion that I'm wrong. I'm willing to examine my ideas, and I'm willing to change my views when I see that I could adopt a better or more superior position. Where my heart is that we've got to debate these issues, and we've got to have it open to all. And I want those internationally participating to understand that the freedoms we enjoy here in the United States that we want to preserve should be around the world. No government, no monopoly, no controller of a channel like YouTube. We don't want tyranny for government. We want all peoples all around the world to truly be able to express without violence, without demeaning one another, without calling names. This is what we will need as a species to advance. The critical thinking, the brilliance of John Stuart Mill's essay on liberty was that he said, we can't examine ideas. We can't know what's working or what's right or wrong until we debate it, until we test it, until we see how it works, until we're willing to critically re-examine things that we believe in. That's what this fight was all about.
That's what Corsi has to say about the Internet Bill of Rights. But also, whenever government enters into this, we know that we have a very corrupt government now. I mean, Trump is just, opening up and exposing much of this swamp and so forth. And the American public is beginning to respond and say, yes, we have corruption at the highest levels. I mean, now we've got this report that's supposed to come out now from the Inspector General, from the Department of Justice, Inspector General Horowitz, and he has released drafts to the Congress and other individuals that were revealed or stated or reported in this particular report. And he's asking for them to make comments or whatever. Now, I think that's going to open it up to something like a really he said, she said type of situation to really fog the report. I believe that Inspector General should have released the report without asking for any comments, period, and let those that were reported by him come up with their own comments on their own media and everything else. This is going to create and taint the report, in my opinion. And so I'm not totally for it, not really. Now, another thing that came up this last week is that John Bolton last Sunday, was on Face the Nation, and he was interviewed, and one of the questions posed to him was about this Libyan, actually it came up offhanded, this Libyan model. In other words, is North Korea going to be following the Libyan model? And the Libyan model was when Omar Gaddafi was disarmed of his nuclear capability. We went in there and he opened up all kinds of sites for inspection. But in the end, then Hillary and Obama go in there and attack him and destroy the country. So, I mean, that's when North Korea came back and said, hey, what's going on over here? And they started balking on the Singapore summit. So I'm going to play what Bolton said being interviewed on Faith the Nation not quite a week ago. So here we go with John Bolton. John Bolton is a hawk all the way. And so I don't know how he got in there. And President Trump's got to be more careful about putting people like him in positions of influence and power. But listen to what John Bolton said not quite a week ago. Here we go right now.
But is it a requirement that Kim Jong-un agree to give away those weapons before you give any kind of concession?
I think that's right. I think we're looking at the Libya model of 2003, 2004. We're also looking at what North Korea itself has committed to previously. And most importantly, I think going back over a quarter of a century to the 1992 Joint North-South Denuclearization Agreement, where North Korea committed to give up nuclear weapons and committed to give up uranium enrichment and plutonium reprocessing. Now, we've got other issues to discuss as well. There are ballistic missile programs, there are biological and chemical weapons programs, there are keeping of American hostages, the abduction of innocent Japanese and South Korean citizens over the years. So there's a lot to talk about.
Will the U.S. accept this invitation from the North to inspect their nuclear site when it's taken down in May as promised?
Well, we'll see exactly what that is. You know, the
South says that's what the North.
The North. Well, it's interesting because we've been to this place before. I hope it's a sincere commitment by the North. But I'll just read you a sentence, if I may, in a gesture demonstrating its commitment to halt its nuclear weapons program. North Korea blew up the most prominent symbol of its plutonium production Friday. The destruction of the cooling tower bore witness to the incremental progress that has been made in U.S.-led multilateral efforts to end North Korea's nuclear weapons program. June 27, 2008, New York Times. Now, the self-same New York Times last month reported that President Trump's going to have difficulty with North Korea because new satellite evidence suggests that North Korea is expanding its plutonium production. So we want to see real commitment. We don't want to see propaganda from North Korea.
You haven't seen such action so far.
We've seen words
so
far.
No dismantlement.
We've seen words so far.
Continued development.
They've said that they're going to give up nuclear testing and ballistic missile testing. They haven't conducted any recently. That's true. That could be a very positive sign. Or it could be a sign that they've reached a level of development where they don't need testing now. We've seen this in other contexts as well. President Trump is determined to see this opportunity through, hopeful that we can get a real breakthrough. But we're not naive in the administration, and a lot's going to ride on this meeting with Kim Jong-un.
So there are these headlines that from South Korea saying Kim Jong-un would abandon his weapons if the U.S. promises not to invade his country. Are you going to make any kind of promise like that?
Well, we've heard this before. This is the North Korean propaganda playbook is an infinitely rich resource.
But it puts a burden on the United States.
I don't think it does, really. I think that if you look at the decision to give up nuclear weapons as a real strategic decision that North Korea has to make, what we want to see from them is evidence that it's real and not just rhetoric. In the case of Libya, for example, and it's a different situation in some respects, those negotiations were carried out in private. They were not known publicly. But one thing that Libya did that led us to overcome our skepticism was that they allowed American and British observers into all their nuclear-related sites. So it wasn't a question of relying on international mechanisms. We saw them in ways we had never seen before.
That sounds like you want inspections before any kind of sanctions relief.
Well, I think it would be a manifestation of the strategic decision to give up nuclear weapons. It doesn't have to be the same as Libya, but it's got to be something concrete and tangible. It may be that Kim Jong-un has some ideas, and we should hear him out.
This is what President Trump does. He's in there with interviewing someone else or talking or negotiating with some world leader. And then the press comes in there and starts asking questions other than what the topic of the discussion is right in front of the cameras. And then Trump offhanded starts giving, you know what I mean, his own opinion and walking back these comments by John Bolton last Sunday. And then he also just continues to muck it up sometimes by his own offhanded remarks. And this is where he's got to be careful in foreign policy. He'll have his foreign policy ministers and so forth and the Secretary of State out there providing some controversy, I mean, some conversation, I should say, with foreign leaders, and then all of a sudden he'll just come in there with some offhanded interview that was not scheduled and not well thought out, and so he's good at it. So here's what he happened to say. He's walking back what John Bolton said about this Libyan model a bit, and then he puts it back in there. So listen to this a second, see what you think. He continually does things like this, and I'll tell you what, the press is just waiting for him. They're just predators, like vultures sitting in trees waiting for him to mess up. But here's the president, his comments on what Bolton is saying about the Libyan model for North Korea.
Chief? Yeah.
Well, the Libyan model isn't a model that we have at all when we're thinking of North Korea. In Libya, we decimated that country. That country was decimated. There was no deal to keep Gaddafi. The Libyan model that was mentioned was a much different deal. This would be with Kim Jong-un, something where he'd be there, he'd be in his country, he'd be running his country. His country would be very rich. His people are tremendously industrious. If you look at South Korea, this would be really a South Korean model in terms of their industry, in terms of what they do. They're hardworking, incredible people. But the Libyan model was a much different model. We decimated that country. We never said to Gaddafi, oh, we're going to give you protection. We're going to give you military strength. We're going to give you all of these things. We went in and decimated him. And we did the same thing with Iraq. Now, whether or not we should have, I could tell you I was against it from the beginning, because look what we have right now. We've spent $7 trillion. Can you believe that? $7 trillion in the Middle East. Right out the window. You might as well throw the money right out the window. And we've done a lot of infrastructure. We just had airports approved. You saw that. A lot of things are happening. But we spent $7 trillion in the Middle East. And look where we are right now. It's pretty sad. But the model, if you look at that model with Gaddafi, that was a total decimation. We went in there to beat him. Now, that model would take place if we don't make a deal, most likely. But if we make a deal, I think Kim Jong-un is going to be very, very happy. I really believe he's going to be very happy. But this is just the opposite. And I think when John Bolton made that statement, he was talking about if we're going to be having a problem, because we cannot let that country have nukes. We just can't do it. So that's the way it meant. It's really just the opposite. Because if you look at Syria, that was a total decimation. Yes, Jen?
What security guarantees are you?
See, that was the president's comment. So he's walking back somewhat. Because what the North Koreans did, they said the Libyan model was when they were disarming Gaddafi, okay? And then all of a sudden later, then they attacked and destroyed him. So is North Korea going to be subjected to the same thing? So this is why North Korea came back and said, hold it. We just may call off this. We're hesitant about this Singapore summit, see. So you've got to be very, very careful when you do such things as this. Now, this last clip is this. There's been controversy about some of these oligarchs that were consulting with, actually working with the FBI under Mueller. And it was trying to bring Levinson back from Iran. They, in 2007, Bob Levinson was kidnapped, we think, or arrested by the Iranian authorities and disappeared into Iran. And he was on Kish Island at the time. He was on his way to the airport, as news articles reported. And all of a sudden, he disappeared into the Iranian, you know, prison system or something. Years later, it was reported that he was being held by the Iranians. And so Levinson had been sent over there on a special mission, had to do with illegal cigarettes. We think that's just a facade to hide his really true, you know what I mean, inner workings there. I'll tell you who has a pretty good insight on this is George Webb, W-E-B-B. Go in there and look at him and see what he says about Kish Island and so forth. But what is going on is that There's been, when the Soviet Union, the wall came down, the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, the Soviet Union started breaking up soon thereafter. And there's material, nuclear material floating around worldwide being traded, on black markets and so forth. And so this uranium one is linked to that, which the Russians eventually gained control of, and Hillary and them approved the eventual consolidation of that under Russian power and control and ownership. So that's just another big corruption scandal that needs to be further investigated. But what George Webb's theory is, and his hypothesis and so forth, is that there'd been this drugs for uranium, or uranium for drugs, international trading of material that people needed for power plants or for nuclear weapons in some of these countries that were fastly developing nuclear arms. And so, but on a secret basis, see. And you had the Saudis in there that had been thirsting for this, for nuclear armament. Of course, the Israelis could have figured into buying some of this also, because they've had a secret, project of nuclear arm for years, see. In Dimona, they're down in the desert, is their secret base for nuclear weaponry and advancement and research and development of it. So anyway, there's other countries out there. Pakistan helped Libya, looks like. Pakistan's been a bad boy over there, you know, trading in these nuclear secrets, and perhaps they helped China early on, and other sort of rogue countries, you know, and Russia's been in there also. The Chernobyl catastrophe actually was in north central Ukraine. People think of it being in Russia, but it was part of the Soviet Union at the time that the Chernobyl plant melted down. But it actually is in north central Ukraine, and there are other plants in that area still generating electricity, see. And there are several of the wisest men in the world said, why use uranium to boil water, you know, and radioactive material, dangerous material to boil water. And so I can understand that for sure. And so That was the president countering somewhat this Libyan model controversy that came out of John Bolton's interview on Face the Nation last Sunday. So coming up next is just a short clip of a BBC, taken out of a BBC documentary about the rise and fall of the Russian oligarchs. And this is insightful because all the big money, They're willing and dealing together. They're buying and selling together. They're rivals at times, they're partners at times. But it's risen to a level with the Rothschilds in there, and the Rockefellers, and all these Oppenheimers, all these real big people. The Venetian family lines are involved in there also. And so you have all these big people, and they're willing and dealing. And so they're together, the big money is together, but they try to portray this as a dialectic of left and right, Democrat Party, Republican Party, and they have us fooled for a long, long time. But they own and control most of the Western central banks in the world. And through that ownership of the central banks, and they monopolize the creation of credit in the world. So I'm going to play this BBC, this short clip that came out of BBC. And there's some very, very Shelley was one of the people. Professor Louis Shelley is quoted in there as these oligarchs don't do anything without permission of Putin, and Putin has the government and the power and all that behind him. So very interesting things. But here we go right now. Listen to this about the BBC, the rise and fall of the Russian oligarchs. But some of it's the Salisbury, this poisoning in Salisbury, the British are still putting out propaganda through the BBC at times. So you can't truly believe, don't believe everything in this clip is what I'm telling you. Just be very skeptical about everything you hear or see. But anyway, they throw that Salisbury thing in there, that poisoning of the Russian and his daughter also. And this is proven to be just an operation probably run by the British. But anyway, listen to this and see what you think. And then I'll close out the program for this weekend. Thank you for being with us.
Every summer, the haves and the have-yots converge for very private holidays. In 2008, Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska sailed to Corfu for one. Lord Mandelson was there. So too was George Osborne. It caused a bit of ado.
I didn't break any rules, but I think I did make a mistake. And I think in politics, it's not just what you say or what you do, it's how things look. And, you know, I'm absolutely honest, this didn't look very good.
They were all guests of financier Nat Rothschild, who owns this villa on the island. What happens in Corfu stays in Corfu. That's the deal. But there was a leak. A newspaper was tipped off that Lord Mandelson had, allegedly, been, quote, dripping pure poison about Gordon Brown in Osborne's ear. Furious at this indiscretion, Nat Rothschild revealed that Osborne went aboard Oleg Deripaska's yacht with a then-Tory fundraiser, Andrew Feldman. Rothschild said they were soliciting a donation, something they deny. Fun fights like those held at Nat Rothschild's villa are moments when British establishment types can get cosy with Russian money, and, whether they know it or not, that means they could be just 2 degrees of separation from the master of the Kremlin himself, Vladimir Putin. Putin demands the loyalty of Russia's billionaires. There are nearly 100 of them. Deripaska is near the top of the list. He's one of the most important links between Putin and the British establishment. Through George Osborne and Tory fundraiser Andrew Feldman, you could say that Putin was just 3 degrees of separation from David Cameron.
I don't think that there's necessarily espionage and blackmail. I think the question of what kind of friends you have is influenced by what you need to understand about the political situation in Russia. And if you understand that oligarchs in Russia today are not independent people, but cannot hold on to their wealth without maintaining good relationships with Putin, then that's something that British politicians need to understand.
In the case of Oleg Deripaska, the American authorities have been more wary than the Brits. The US has denied Oleg Deripaska a visa. Mr. Deripaska made his mega fortune in the 1990s after Russia's aluminium wars, so-called, because some proprietors were literally killing off the competition. There's no suggestion that Mr. Deripaska was involved in violence. But surviving in that environment was tough.
It was very difficult. But I believe whatever I did, I can't say that I'm proud, but I believe, you know, that I did the right thing.
Mr. Deripaska told the High Court in London in 2012 that he'd been forced to pay protection money to a man with links to organized crime. One of Mr. Deripaska's new business associates is former Energy Minister Gregg, now Lord Barker, another David Cameron chum. He's the chair of Deripaska's energy company, N+, which was recently allowed to list on the London Stock Exchange. And this week it was revealed by the Financial Times that N+ is one of the clients of Lord Mandelson's strategic advice consultancy, Global Counsel. Global Counsel says neither Lord Mandelson nor Mr. Deripaska are involved in this work. Deripaska is big news in Russia at the moment. Opposition politician Alexei Navalny recently released this documentary about him. It includes footage of Deripaska on his yacht entertaining one of Russia's most senior government officials. It was filmed by an escort, 19 years old at the time. In London, a company run by the Home Secretary's brother, Roland Rudd, handled the PR for the recent stock market flotation of Deripaska business, N+.
I mean, I'm not in the PR business, but I think that when one is the immediate family of somebody in a top leadership position, one should be careful about what foreign professionals, what foreign clients one has.
Donald Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, has worked for Mr. Deripaska too, something Mr. Deripaska is not keen to talk about without an appointment.
Get lost, please. Thank you.
At Tory fundraiser, the Black and White Ball, the British wives of oligarchs bid big money for experiences, like having dinner with Gavin Williamson, the Defence Secretary. It's clear from our research that several wealthy oligarchs close to Vladimir Putin have managed to cultivate members, whether witting or unwitting, of the British ruling elite. Getting involved in the art world, donating money to charities, sponsoring academic prizes, buying shares in football clubs, these are the ways that Putin's cronies can become friends of the posh folk of London. But if the businesses are legal and the stock exchange is happy, should we
care? There's a danger here in smearing all Russians. Look, there are lots of very gifted entrepreneurs, artists, rebels in London today. And it'd be awful to sort of have a total attack on all Russians in London. It's wonderful that we have this expatriate Russian community. But political parties should be very careful, and government should be very careful about who it does business with and takes money from.
People are saying there's a problem with Jeremy Corbyn and Seamus Milne's judgment about Russia. That's the only problem of Russian influence in British politics. True or false?
Oh, false. It's got to be said that the Conservative Party has been very rash in some of its who it's taken money from and who it's done business with. And of course, New Labour, which is currently on the warpath against Jeremy Corbyn, has all kinds of questions to ask.
But Russian money is washed around the corridors of power in London for perhaps too long. The question is, will the nerve agent poisonings in Salisbury change anything? Or will it continue to be rubles as usual?
See, that's a BBC, you know, reporting. But you have to remember that the City of London is still the financial center of the world. And that's about 1.1 square miles in downtown London on the Thames River. And it controls much of the financial health and so forth and prosperity in the world. And so you've got to say the British Crown at the top of this. In fact, the Prime Minister of Great Britain has to meet with her weekly and give her an update and report, Queen Elizabeth. So this crown being not, you know, is a very big power. And she has a Commonwealth of Nations also that she's just reordered recently in favor of her son. But this wedding today that's occurring in Great Britain, where they're about 6 hours ahead of us clockwise. And so Harry did find himself a bride. He got married. His bride's father deferred to come in there and participate and walk her down the aisle. He think he had some heart trouble or something, but that wasn't well, taken up by the royal family. And I think William, is in there too, of having problems. Now, what we have also, though, coming out of Saudi Arabia, we don't know for sure if these are reliable reports or not. Some say that it's just a false rumor on the internet, but The Guardian and so forth are making reports that confirm possibly that this has happened. And we have Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman reported that was killed. There was an attack on a palace, their palace, main palace in Riyadh on April 21st. And according to some sources and reports, there were armored vehicles surrounding the palace and attacking the palace with heavy arms fire and so forth. So there's reports now that perhaps Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was attacked and killed, shot two or three times, but he hasn't been seen prominently in the press or media or anything else since then. And so they put together a little bit of a video, but we don't know the date of that video. So we know this goes back to last year of October 1st in Las Vegas. And what erupted there was, we believe, a fight between these two factions in Saudi Arabia. And I believe that Trump would come down on the present King Salman, side. And then there was this other rambunctious, rebellious faction led by his adversaries that were really tied into the big money, see, worldwide big money, big investments. And so Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman arrested a bunch of them and then confined them until they paid him into the billions of dollars. And so that didn't go down well. And then he's going to allow Saudi women to drive, which they've been, you know, trying to secure for years. But, and also he's allowing movies and things like that that were never even ever allowed to be seen in Saudi Arabia. So your hardline Islam clerics and so forth are very critical about what the Crown Prince is doing in this liberalization. And so it could very well be that this he's getting some blowback from other factions within Saudi Arabia. And then you got the Yemen rebels, and they're shooting missiles in. There were reports of in Syria of hit and run attacks by your rebels in there and your ISIS elements and remnants and so forth. So it's very, very difficult sometimes to get all this together. We've had the recent visit and the dedication of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, and Ivanka and her husband, Jared Kushner, were there, and he spoke. And of course, this is Netanyahu's crowning achievement for the Israeli state, is to have that new U.S. embassy locate in Jerusalem. Because what it does is say, yes, we approve and put a stamp of approval on the Israeli state. And of course, you had Hagee there, Dr. Hagee out of San Antonio. He's a Christian Zionist, and he's led all of these supports for the Zionist state from the Christian, you could say, right in the country. And of course, that goes back to the Scofield Bible and la-da-da-da-da. I mean, these things are not simple to talk about, because we've got some really fine people that are involved in these very, you could say, messianic, you know what I mean, types of religious thinking and views. And so as a result, when you have a dominating thought or a viewpoint, that is sometimes it can be all consuming. And this is part of what we're talking about when we're talking about the ideas that begin to dominate. I think H.G. Wells says the thought prison. So my work has been to try to reveal how those thoughts imprison us and trying to free us. And I'm not a libertarian and just do your own thing either, because I believe in principles and morals and along the lines of the Ten Commandments and things like that. And the golden rule, and above all, forgiveness is what I talk about most of the time. So anyway, you've got this thriving mentality in America, and it's been seeded in and by our enemies. Antonio Gramsci, this is a good point, time to bring him up. He's the founder of the Italian Communist Party. He was advocating the way to spread communism, to take over the West, was to destroy its culture. And so he was at odds at the time with Joseph Stalin, who was more of a nationalist concerning communism, and he gradually came around to an international movement. But he didn't agree totally with Antonio Gramsci, who was the founder of the Italian Communist Party. But anyway, what's happened that I see is, yes, Antonio Gramsci was right. The attack on America in particular, the attack on America, it had to do with a lot of different factions and ideas. And some of it could be related back to a New Age type thing. Aldous Huxley immigrated to America and settled down on the West Coast and started writing and teaching from a new age, a new world, you know, age viewpoint. And his writings, he wrote a couple of fine books, Brave New World and Return to Brave New World, that I read years ago. The Island was another one. But Aldous Huxley was a fine writer in this area. And of course, everyone, you know, 1984, you know, that was out there for years also. It was interesting. I took freshman English in 1962 at the University of Texas, and my English professor had us read 1984 and write a book report on it. I think that was the first thing that we ever did, assignment, outside assignment reading. But that English professor then was pretty far advanced. Years later, in 1984, I attended a seminar at the University of Texas held at the Student Union. And it had to do with different ideas. And one of them was a speech given by the Scientology people on mind control and so forth. And there again, I mean, we're talking about cultic thinking on all levels. And let me tell you about cults, okay? When people get together and they start organizing any kind of a group, and it doesn't matter the foundations, it could be a religious, political, could be a hobby or whatever, but people start getting together and forming groups, then those things can become cultic. I mean, not that all cults are bad. Some are benign and some are very, very ugly and very evil. Say, you got satanic and Luciferian cults, and you have other kinds. You could say that the political parties have become cultic in a sense, you know, and so forth. But when these cults get together and they start advocating and promulgating a set of beliefs and so forth, then they're saying I'm okay and the opposition or our adversaries are no good, see. This is the mechanism of control of the upper level, you could say elitist in the world. What we're talking about here is something that early on, it was finally realized through the, from out of the temples of Babylon came some of the first banking practices. And so some of those first banking practices realized that there's a lot of power in money power and interest accumulation and so forth. And so those interests were first, the first bankers were the priests. The priests in the temples could calculate interest, okay? And so you had usury that was born out of the temples of Babylon and other, you could say, religious institutions in the Middle East there. And so out of that arose a very powerful arm of modern banking today that has been very dominant. So today it's been much more, you could say, refined in the sense of international banks, the Bank of International Settlements, all these central banks, privately owned most of them, like our Federal Reserve. And so the banking community has been dominant and has secured a dominance through money power. Now we get back to England again, see. We get back to the City of London where many of your financial, you know, transactions are concluded there and calculated there and so forth. So you've got that as a, now Frankfurt's coming on. New York's always been an international banking center also. And then Singapore, the reason why this summit meeting is down in Singapore because Singapore is becoming an international banking and money center in the Far East. So you can't ever forget that either. And some of these legacy funds are just tremendously large in scope, billions and billions of money, and they're investing on behalf of the citizens that are usually members of those. And so you've got really a tremendous, funds that these countries administer and control. And so anyway, getting back to the final conclusion about what to do and how to do it is that if you begin to forgive yourself and others, you begin to dissolve that false self. And as you dissolve that false self, you can begin to become gradually, slowly but gradually, and for sure, more objective about yourself and the world. As you become more objective about yourself and the world, then you begin to know thyself or know yourself better. See what I mean? And in becoming to know yourself better, you're beginning to see all the weaknesses and the strengths, all the aspirations that are realizable or not. There are dreams out there. Keep dreaming. Don't turn your back on your dreams. They're always possible. They have to be thought of before they can become reality. Like Think and Grow Rich, there was a deal that a dominating thought will eventually reproduce itself in outward physical reality. And that is true to a certain extent, see. I mean, there are some things that are just, you know, impossibilities possibly because the person thinking those thoughts can think thoughts, but they don't have the capability, the money, or the talent or anything else to put certain things together, see. But anyway, when you begin to forgive, then you're dissolving this false self. You're becoming more objective. And then there's a movement that I talk about in my writings and so forth, is that you return to the real self. And the real self is conscience-based. So I see this as a couple of concepts, very general. One would be a state of consciousness, which is a physical state. And the other state I created myself, a state of consciousness, which is a spiritual state. So we're in a rebellion or conformity, according to Roy Masters. He came up with some of these ideas about being in going back and forth, or being in a mixture of conformity and rebellion. So I agree with that. And Roy Masters has put forward the Institute of Human Understanding, put together some fine writings and so forth about human psychology and about how we think and how we react. And he's always saying that we're always reacting to someone that's critical of us or fighting with us and so forth. And then when we react in a negative way like that, then they have us. They have our goat, see. So he's really, you know, spearheaded a lot of interesting thinking and so forth. And I want to just say a few things here, a minute or so, about Joy Hansen, Mike Hansen's mother. And she passed away just a few days ago, and I think the funeral is today. This is Saturday, May the 19th. And she was a wonderful person. She had a wonderful family. She had Mike and his twin sister and then another son. And but she was really nice. And what was... She spent her most of her career in nursing. I think she did a lot of nursing home inspection for the state. And above all, though, is that she her name was Joy. So, and she was very up and positive to be around. I met her a couple, two or three times. But every time I met her, she was always up and jovial and joy, a joy to be around. So I'm sort of dedicating this program to Joy and her family, and her funeral is today. And Mike and all those other people out there, especially Mike Hansen. Mike Hansen has been a very, very, on the patriot side, a shining light of freedom and liberty. And anyone that knows him personally will confirm what I've just said about Mike Hansen. And so anyway, I want to thank Mike and all those people, Alex Jones and Roy Masters and all these people out there that have done a lot. And Jerome Corsi, he's fighting his way back from a great criticism because he stood up and called it like it was. And you can't get any better than that. So I also thank Jerome Corsi for all his hard work and his 36 books or more that he's written, trying to bring us a little bit of freedom, liberty. But most of all, Jerome Corsi and many of these other people are trying to stand on truth. And truth is hard to get to sometimes. It's not that easy. The clouds of evil are always out there. And they can cloud and taint anything that we're trying to do and twist and turn it and destroy it. But anyway, keep positive, but be wary of the darkness and do the best you can. Thank you for listening this evening, and God bless each and every one of you.